Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and of course, you'll have an opportunity to join the conversation with your questions. Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, will be here in a few minutes. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. We're going to start with this scenario. Imagine that you are at an outdoor gathering. You've got a cup with a little something sweet in it, and a wasp shows up, eager to partake. This time of year, wasps are often present and visible. Iowa State University Professor of Entomology Donald Lewis is here to help us understand these persistent but unpopular guests. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Good to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And we are talking about a specific class of wasps that we tend to see this time of year, right?
Right. We're talking about the social wasps. And these are wasps that have a colony. They have a queen, they have workers who are doing the work for the queen, and they have spent the summer growing their population, gathering food to feed the queen's offspring. And when we get to the fall of the year, the job for those workers is about over. The queen has stopped reproducing, there's no longer larvae in the colony that need to be fed and taken care of. So they're pretty much waiting to die.
And with time, and that's why they want to come to all your parties.
And they're with time on their hands, they're out just looking for what they can find. Now, when they were feeding the queen's offspring back in the summer, they were gathering flies and caterpillars and carrying that back to the nest, chopping it up into little pieces of sushi that they fed to the queen's offspring, which are larvae. They no longer need the protein to feed the offspring. And so their dietary requirement, their dietary desire, turns more toward sugar, which is why we find them at picnics down in your Coke can, down in your soft drink. They're floating in your Kool-Aid because they were out, or they're feeding on the fruit as it grows on your tree because they're looking now for sugar and moisture.
All right. So they're around. They're visible right now, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there are more of them now than there were earlier in the summer.
Well, it started with one. Each colony of social insects, the yellow jackets, the bumblebees, the bald-faced hornets, the paper wasps, it all started with one back in April or May. And this was a queen who hibernated through the winter, found a place to start a colony, and produced a small number of offspring who became workers that began doing the tasks of building the nest and feeding the colony. As the summer went along, that population grew from one queen initially to a few hundred yellow jackets, to 100 or so bald-faced hornets, to several dozen paper wasps. So yes, the population started at one, reached its peak here in the end of the summer, and by Thanksgiving, they will have all frozen to death and be gone.
All right. So a lot of people, when they start having that wasp buzz around their soda can, that kind of thing, freak out. And we're afraid of these insects. So tell me a little bit about the risks that we face when we interact with wasps.
It's not a great risk when you compare it to other things that you do, like dart across traffic in front of a bus. There are much riskier things to do. The Centers for Disease Control recently documented that over the last decade or so, 62 people per year in the United States died of wasp or bee stings. So the risk of fatality is really low from these things. Now, it is going to hurt when they sting, and unless you're allergic, that's sort of the end of it. If you have an allergy to wasp and bee stings, you probably already know that. You may be carrying an EpiPen, and you know to seek medical attention if you are stung. The rest of us, it's likely to have a local reaction. It's going to hurt for a while. We'll treat it topically. But if there's ever swelling away from the site, then we do need to seek that medical attention. But when you're around wasps and bees, the best thing to do is remain calm. Don't wave your arms. Don't go running and screaming. Just try to back away from the situation. Stay calm, try to separate yourself from it as best you can.
All right. And it's only the females that tend to sting, is this?
It's only the females that can sting.
All right.
The stinger on wasps and bees is a modification of the egg-laying organ called the ovipositor, and only females have that structure. And in the case of the social wasps and some of our other stinging insects, only the females have that structure with which they can inject venom into either a host or a prey, or inject venom into an intruder to try to make them go away. Now, males can't sting because in place of that ovipositor and stinger, the males have other equipment, if you get my drift.
All right. So you can ask if it's a male or female. If you're then you can decide how concerned you want to be.
You can ask. You can check. but the thing is, especially in the fall of the year, most of them are going to be females, and that's because that's the greatest number. That colony that started with a queen and built to a few hundred yellow jackets produced a couple dozen males. So there were a few hundred females, but only a couple dozen males whose job it is to fly off from the colony, find a new queen that was produced in the colony, and start and mate with her so that she can start over the following year. The ones you see out and about right now are likely to be females.
All right. We don't need to be as scared of them as most of us are, is what I'm hearing you saying. But why should we appreciate them? What is it that wasps bring into the world that is beneficial?
All summer long, when they were raising the queen's offspring, whether they were bald-faced hornets, paper wasps, or yellow jackets, they were gathering food for the offspring, and that was other insects. They were gathering flies, they were gathering caterpillars. So the paper wasp that was in your garden was walking around on your cabbage leaves looking for a cabbage looper or a cabbage worm and found that, caught it, stung it to paralyze it so that it would stop wiggling, and then flew back to the nest carrying that caterpillar. They are great biological controls as predators eating other insects and especially eating some of the pests out of our garden and landscape. So we love them. We should leave them alone. We should tolerate them for the benefit that they provide. And if they would just nest far away from my front door, I would coexist with them very easily.
Which they're not always going to do. And you mentioned paper wasps. You mentioned bald-faced hornets, which both of them really make elaborate nests. Tell me a little bit about that.
In both cases, and even the yellow jackets, who nest mostly underground or in hollow spaces, they build a nest out of paper. And that's one of the differences between wasps and bees. Wasps make nests out of paper, and bees make nests out of wax. So just by looking at the nest, we can tell. The yellow jackets and bald-faced hornets make combs. They're layers of combs. They're these little cells that will hold the larvae while they're being fed and while they're growing. And then they enclose the whole thing in a paper envelope. So if you've seen a bald-faced hornet hanging in a tree or on the side of a building, or if you've seen one at a campground, often museums and nature centers have these on display. You see it as a big ball of what looks like gray paper mache. And that's the exterior covering that is concealing all the activity that went on inside. And that covering and the nest of the paper wasp is made out of a combination of wood fibers and wasp spit. So they gather wood fibers from dead limbs and from your porch railings. They chew that up, they mix it with the saliva, and then they press it out into these little thin sheets of paper and make these huge structures by the end of the summer.
It's really incredible. And I know some people, when they come across one of those structures, particularly with the paper wasps, if it's in the shed or, you know, near the front door, that kind of thing, their first reaction is to try to get rid of that. Now, within a season, if you try to get rid of a wasp nest, what happens?
Well, if you the way we would suggest getting rid of it is to wait till dark, go back out after night with an aerosol spray that is made for wasps and hornets, and it will shoot 10 to 15 feet. You don't have to get really close. You can stand back. You can stay at a safe distance. It's nighttime. They won't be able to see you. They're not active. They are all on the nest. And you can spray that insecticide on the nest and kill them that way. If you just knock it down and the wasps are still in there, they'll probably try to continue to grow or to grow the larvae that you've knocked down, but they'll probably just rebuild it. So you can discourage them, but you can't really eliminate them unless you kill the entire group.
Will they come back to the same spot next year?
Wasps will frequently, especially paper wasps, will come back to an area that has ideal nesting, and that's under the eaves of your house, up under the peak where they're sheltered from wind and rain, in the shelter of your porch. They may come back to that area, but the nest itself is never used again. The bald-faced hornet's nest that's the size of a basketball is going to disintegrate over the winter. They will never use that again. They never come back to reuse a nest, and if they come back to the same location, it was an accident, probably because of the convenience and not because of anything that was left behind by one nest to attract the next one.
All right, and they love to attend our outdoor gatherings this time of year. When do they disappear?
Especially the yellow jackets. They just really love potato salad and sweet beverages. And
they do.
On warm days, we see them around the trash barrels on campus where they'll be down in feeding on the little remnants of candy bars that are in the wrappers and so forth. They also know the difference between real soda and diet soda. They are not fooled by that, by the way. But they are at their peak, and it's a downhill slide from here until Thanksgiving. And when we get some freezing weather, they start to die off. They're already dying of old age. And by the time we get through Thanksgiving and several frosts and freezes, that population will be gone.
And how do they come back next spring? You already gave us a few clues about this, but what happens once the freeze comes?
At the end of the summer, that colony produced new queens. These are fertile females who have the ability to lay eggs the following year if they are mated. The queens left the nest. They found males from other colonies flying around the county. They mated in the air. The female that is mated, and the new queen, goes into hibernation in the wood pile, under the loose bark of dead trees, down in the brush somewhere, and she just waits through winter with the ability to hibernate. The rest of the population, the workers, the old queen, the females, they don't have that ability to stay alive through freezing temperatures, so they're going to die. But the whole future of the species has been invested in that queen who will hibernate through the winter, start over from scratch the following year, and do it all again just so she can produce new queens at the end of the next summer that will go into hibernation and keep it going.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Iowa State University Professor of Entomology, Donald Lewis. We've been talking about social wasps, and of course, we'll also take your questions. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Iowa State University Professor of Entomology, Donald Lewis. We've been talking about wasps, but now you can ask questions about insects or plants. Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron is also here. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. And we've got a whole bunch of people already on the phone, but you can join us at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Before we get to the phones, Donald, I want to ask you a question that we've gotten a lot on the show throughout the summer. I think we'll always get this, which is, where have all the bees gone? Why don't I see any bees in my garden? That's a question you get all the time, right?
I get that all the time. And when we're talking about wasps, I get that question plus the opposite question, why are there so many wasps? Insect populations vary greatly from place to place and from time to time, and how many you see may depend on where you're looking and how you are looking. But it's a common question. People do perceive that there are fewer bees now than there used to be. Partly it's because there are fewer wild honeybees because of diseases that are in the colonies. If you look early in the season, you don't see bumblebees, but you do now because their population has grown through the year. So some of it is actual decline in insects. Some of it is just the way we are looking and where we are looking. But I don't have an easy answer. Let's put it that way.
All right. But a lot of it is circumstantial, where your garden is not necessarily representative of all gardens everywhere. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. It is circumstantial. I'll have to remember that phrase.
All right. Okay, let's go to the phone. Cheryl is on the line in Pilot Mound. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, good morning. I apologize because I think this question may have been addressed earlier in the season, but I probably missed it. But we have two burning bushes, beautiful ones, that I assume that was rabbit damage maybe this winter. Anyhow, the top portion has greened up, the bottom portion is greening up, but the middle is gone. So should those be trimmed down to the bottom portion of the bush, or would, is it possible that next year the middle would fill in?
It could fill in, but you can definitely prune it. And late winter, early spring, March would be a good time. And what you could possibly do is, if the middle is kind of bare, maybe prune it back to where the bottom growth is present. Mm-hmm. And so it can kind of fill back in. You can do that. But I think the main problem this past winter was the extreme cold we had this past winter.
Okay.
And that did damage quite a few burning bushes in Iowa.
So it damaged them to the point that they do need, they probably are not, that portion of the bush is not going to come back.
Well, some of the plants were so badly damaged that the upper two-thirds, the upper three-fourths of the actual shrub did not leaf out. The only growth occurred near the bottom. And in that case, they had no choice but to prune out the dead.
Right. We do have a choice here, and I think they'll be so short if we prune them clear back, you know, but I just didn't know what the odds are that next year would be better. We won't know, huh?
Well, I think there's a pretty good chance they'll gradually fill that back in. If you have good growth at the bottom, good growth at the top, most likely they'll fill that back in, yes.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Cheryl.
Sure.
Worth making the gamble for next year, right?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, let's go next to Dustin in Blairstown. Hello, Dustin.
Hey, Charity. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So yesterday, not yesterday, Wednesday, I was doing some work in Marengo, Iowa, and we drove past this house, and it looked like a rhubarb plant or a rhubarb patch. But it literally was 10 to 12 foot tall. I've never seen that. I don't even know if it's possible, but it had the red stalks and the leaves were big and shaped very similarly. So my question is that possible? Is that what it could be? And if not, what is that mimicking plant and how?
What's going on?
Well,
all right.
It is not rhubarb. It is not. It's some other plant. I would probably have to see some photos to maybe identify that if you want to do that. Is it producing any type of flowering structure at all? Have you noticed that?
It didn't look like it.
Okay.
Again, it was in somebody's yard, and it just piqued my curiosity to the point where I was looking forward to today to call and ask. But literally, the stalks, I mean, looked like pink and reddish and had almost a similar thickness, but obviously must be pretty hardy to have it be growing that tall. And then the leaves were big fanned leaves. So it literally looked like a rhubarb patch on steroids.
Yeah, it wasn't rhubarb. I mean, if you get a chance to take some photos of the plant, I would like to see maybe the entire plant from top to bottom, and then maybe a close-up of some of the foliage. And if you can do that, you can send those photos, attach those photos to an email, and send that to Hortline, which is HORTLINE at iastate.edu.
All right, Dustin, you've piqued all of our curiosities, I think. But thanks a lot for your call. I hope you get the answer you're looking for. If you have a question, you could call 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Let's go next to Alfonso in Urbandale. Hi, Alfonso.
Hi, how's it going? My question was really getting more information about this wasp I encountered. So I had gone to see the sunset at Sellerville Dam, and on my way back to the store buying something, I found this wasp inside my car. And it looked like a dragonfly / ant.
Okay.
And I took a video and a picture of it too. But I ended up going back home and spending that Saturday night and that Sunday, couple hours on Sunday, trying to look for this particular insect, which I found out it was a wasp. And the name that I found was an American Pedlicinid wasp.
Okay.
Which is all black, looks like a dragonfly, and an ant. So I'm not sure if you guys have more details about it or I'm just curious.
Yeah. What was the name after American Pelicimid?
Yes.
Okay.
Which the one that I saw, I guess, is a female.
Sure. And there was just one, right?
Yes.
Okay. It wasn't a colony. There are solitary wasps. We spent the first part of the show talking about social wasps that build a colony. Then there are other wasps where each female works by herself, for herself, with no help from daughters, no help from anybody else to build a nest. And the large black wasp you're talking about, and there are like three of these that are common in Iowa, where they have kind of a shiny blue-black appearance. They frequently nest in the ground, and they have made their nest for the year, and their work is done. So she was probably just hanging out, waiting for fall like the rest of us. But these are digger wasps. I think I'm on the right track with the name you've given. These are digger wasps that burrow in the ground and provision nests with food for their offspring.
All right. Does that satisfy your curiosity, Alfonso?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm just curious because what I read online was that they're so rare seen, and that especially the males, there's just hardly any pictures out there online because I Google it. So I found the right insect that I saw, the wasp, on insectidentification.org.
Okay.
And it didn't have too much details about this particular wasp. I was just curious if you guys knew more about it.
Let me see if I can help you after I look at the pictures or the video that you sent. So Richard gave you his email address. Mine is similar, except that it is insects, I-N-S-E-C-T-S, insects, plural, insects, at iastate.edu. So send me what you've got, and I'll see if I can give you more information.
All right, Alfonso, thanks for your call. And I love that you spent 3 or 4 hours looking for more information about that insect. That's an entomologist's dream come true, isn't it, Donald?
Well, you know, we all wish we had that kind of time to sit and stare and
watch
these.
You've got priorities.
That's right. I got things
to
do.
Well, good job, Alfonso. And next up, let's go to Marilyn in Eldora. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question about bumblebees. My son has a utility shed that needs repainting. I weeded next to it and discovered that there were bumblebees going in and out of a hole in the ground right next to the shed. I got stung twice just trying to pull weeds. But when will they go dormant so that we can paint that shed without killing the bees?
They have an annual colony. Bumblebees start over from scratch every year. Back in May, a queen found an old mouse burrow, or there was some sort of a depression that she was able to use as her nesting site. She's produced a few dozen bumblebees by the end of the season, and like the social wasps, queens have been produced. They will go into hibernation. The rest of the colony will freeze to death. You know, if I said Thanksgiving, I think we would be safe in most years, that colony will have died by then. But if we get the long, non-freezing fall that we're hoping for with our crops, it could be a little later than that. Now, your alternative is to paint at night.
Oh, boy.
So you could be doing it now, but with a miner's cap on your head so that you had a light to paint by. But at night, you can work around them with less risk. But When bumblebees are at flowers foraging, we can be right up amongst them and there's no threat to us. They're so busy gathering nectar and pollen that they will ignore us. But when you're at their nest, and especially if you're stomping around and poking at the nest, they will come out to defend it. And that's the worst situation, is to be at the nest and aggravating either bumblebees or social wasps.
Sure. So how about next spring? Can I wait till next spring?
Oh, sure. By winter, they will have completely frozen. Through the winter, they will have completely frozen, and that colony will be gone. First thing next spring, do the landscaping to make sure there's no hole there for somebody else to move in. But that colony will be gone by Thanksgiving to Christmas.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. That sounds much, much better than painting at night. But, you know, everybody likes different things. 866-780-9100 is the number to call with your question. You can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Let's go next to Dennis in Marshalltown. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I don't have enough information, I think, for anybody to really determine what I got. But I got a sandbox, you know, that my kids grew up, and it's just nobody uses it, and it's just overgrown with weeds now. And this year, I don't know what it is, but it's over 12 feet tall.
The case of the giant weed today on Talk of Iowa.
Okay, does it have any distinguishing characteristics?
Up on the top, it looks like somebody, you know, it's like got like a tassel up on top. It's all like, you know, like an umbrella shape, sort of. And then further down, it kind of looks like a corn plant, a corn stalk, but it's not a corn stalk. The leaves look kind of broad and long, and they come to a point.
So you're describing a grass, right?
Say what?
You're describing a grass?
Some type?
No, it's not a grass.
Okay.
I don't know what it is. When I talked to the caller, I said, I don't have enough information I can't believe
it. Again, I think we're going to have to see some photos, especially of that tassel-like thing at the top, and maybe an overall picture of the plant itself.
All right, Dennis, thanks a lot for your call. And I will say, we're getting a lot of suggestions for what Dustin might have seen. Let's focus on questions this hour. So you can give us a call with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Suggestions such as pokeberry weed or giant burdock.
Right.
Who knows?
Those came to my mind, too. Yes.
So, good work, but let's focus on questions. Here's an email from Mary Lynn. I have a yellow-leafed sumac bush or tree that grows very well in a partial shaded area of my yard. Over the past few years, it has produced numerous shoots that are growing vigorously. Mm-hmm. I'd like to transplant some of the shoots to another area, but I haven't had success. It seems that when the rhizome connection to the main plant is cut, the shoot suffers. I've tried carefully digging them up and immersing roots in water, or planting in potting soil with generous watering, but the shoots just don't survive. Do you have any suggestions for transplanting sumac?
Well, if I was going to try doing that, I would do so in early spring before the plant begins to leaf out. So just leave that little sprout there over winter and then go out early next spring, like in early to mid-April, dig it up carefully, put it in the ground, keep it well watered, and I think it has a fairly good chance of surviving.
All right. Here's a question from Herb in Des Moines. I've been noticing many more webs of fall webworm in the Des Moines area. Is this a common complaint this fall? These tree defoliators are much more common in the south.
It varies greatly from place to place and year to year. It's been a few years since we've seen very many fall webworms. What we're talking about is a loosely woven gray web or a tent that is out on the end of the branches. And they started in July. It was the size of a tennis ball. And by now, it could be the size of a basketball as big as half a bushel basket. Inside there, there's 150 to 200 little fuzzy caterpillars that have eaten the leaves inside the web. And when they ran out of leaves, they made the web bigger. And that's why it went from small size to large size. Now we're at the end of the season. The webs are as large as they're going to get. The important thing to remember is that only the leaves inside the web were eaten. So that's a really small percentage of the total leaves on the tree, and it has no impact on the tree whatsoever. But my experience, and Herb's probably relating to this, that people hate this thing like it's happening to them personally. And they want to burn them out. They want to chop them out. They want to do something to get rid of this web. It'll disappear in time. The story is over. The caterpillars have eaten the leaves. Live and let live.
All right. Try not to take it as a personal affront.
That's right.
Donald Lewis, professor of entomology at Iowa State University. Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. They are here to answer your questions. Give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you can join the conversation with your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And let's do a couple more email questions here, then we'll get back to the phones. Rosie in Ames wonders, my clematis are drying out. I would like to cut them down to about a foot from the ground. I've read that clematis bloom on the previous year's growth. I'm fine if they don't bloom next year, but I'd really like to know how to raise healthy clematis plants.
Well, actually, there are different types. And many of the ones that we commonly grow actually bloom on the current year's growth. Some do bloom on last year's growth, but most bloom on new year's growth. And as far as what they like a consistently moist soil. And so in the Ames area, that's been lacking this year. We've been dry relatively recently, so basically what they should do is provide ample moisture when it's dry, so they have a consistent moisture supply, so maybe water once a week during prolonged dry periods. And most of those prefer like partial sun, maybe morning sun, afternoon shade. That's what they kind of like. And if they have those two things and something to grow on, they typically do fine.
All right, here's a question from John in Clark County. We saw dozens of dragonflies almost every day in August in our yard. They seem to have been more prevalent than previous years. Are we correct in that observation?
Dragonflies are easy to identify. They're large size. They have those cellophane wings, and they fly with a very distinctive zigzag pattern. They fly very quickly. Often when you see swarms of them, they will be 6 to 12 feet off the ground, so it's kind of easy to watch what's going on. But this is just one of those phenomena that John is among the lucky few walking the face of the earth that got to see this. I've seen it once in my life where there was somewhere in the river system around me, and it has to be within 2 miles, there's no river within 2 miles of my house, there was this huge emergence of dragonflies. They ended up over my street swarming back and forth, eating ant swarmers out of the air. So it happens. I don't know what triggers a large emergence of dragonflies, but the good news is dragonflies live in clean water of rivers and streams, and so it's an indication of good water quality. Thank you, dragonflies. Go eat more mosquitoes and gnats for us.
All right, so you just got lucky enough to see it.
Exactly.
All right, let's go to the phones. Dee is on the line next in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Dee.
Oh, hi. My call is about catnip. Now, last year, most of my plants died, and what survived was real straggly. And, you know, having a cat, you know, it's very important that I have the catnip. But this year, I've got a bumper crop. I mean, I've got plants growing wherever, you know, I don't know if the seeds are carried in the wind or what, but they're just growing all over the place.
Well, it's a very...
So I just want to know what the difference.
Well, it's a very tough, resilient plant. So, in fact, it can be kind of hard to kill. So I think it just had a very good growing season. It's doing very well this year. We had ample moisture this spring, and so it's just doing very nicely.
Oh, okay. But that's simple.
Yep.
Okay.
Lucky cat.
Yeah.
Oh, he loves it. Okay, well, thank you so much for answering my question.
Thanks a lot for your call, Dee. Next, let's go to Phyllis in Preston. Hi, Phyllis.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
My question has to do with mason bees.
Okay.
I have seen advertisements of mason bee houses.
Sure.
I'm wondering about the nature of these bees. Are they stingers, or would they be preferable to put around a garden for pollination?
We have mason bees. We already have them in the state. We probably have several species of them. Mason bee is in a huge group that are collectively referred to as sweat bees. So if that conjures up an image of a shiny green or a shiny blue small bee that may try to sting you, but it doesn't feel like it hurts very much, that would be a description of mason bees as well. They get the name mason because they build their nest in hollow tubes. It could be a hollow stem, or it could be the paper straws that you have stuck into a container and put out on a fence post. They build that nest, but they seal it shut with mud. So it looks like a mason, a bricklayer, came along and sealed up the end of those tubes. Yes, you can put out tubes. You can make these yourself. There are instructions online. You can buy them. This is a classic example, though, of just because you build it doesn't mean they will come.
But they're so cute, Donald.
When it happens, it's just exciting. But lots and lots of mason bee structures are out there. Bee hotels is another name for them. We're waiting for the leaf cutter bees and the other sweat bees and the mason bees. We're just waiting for them to come. And it's kind of disappointing that mostly what we get in them are spiders and wasps. But it's great to try. It's fun to do. It's not a great investment. And maybe you'll be the lucky one and get to see the whole process.
Well, and to be a little bit of a downer here, Donald, I read something about thinking that maybe these bee hotels are actually negative because they don't get cleaned and renewed.
Yes, that came out recently that like every other organism, there are diseases for bees. They get viruses and bacteria and fungi, and they get sick and they die. And when they are crowded together, those pathogens are easily shared. And this is a nest where there's a lot of offspring in one little tube or one little straw. And if one had a disease, they probably all had it. And if you didn't take that straw out and throw it away at the end of the year, you've now perpetuated that pathogen to the following year. So we're learning that these are great activities to do, but there are some consequences, and we just need to keep learning and being smarter about it.
All right, Phyllis, thanks for your call. Chris is up next in Ames. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I've got a good one for you, Donald.
Okay.
With all of this terrible weather in the Southwest and the Caribbean, what do all of the flying and crawling creatures do? Do they evacuate before all this stuff happens, since they have a lot of lead time, or is there a lot of death, or what happens?
There's probably a lot of death, and the rest of them, at the first sign of anything that's greater than their tolerance for flight, they probably just hunker down. So if they hunkered down at the seashore, they got swept away with the storm surge. If they hunkered down on higher ground, they may have been able to stay there. But we know insects also blow in the wind. The answer to the question, Charity, finally blowing in the wind. It could be insects. And not just
sure that was intended.
Not just the answer. So we have things like corn earworm every year in Iowa, and we have painted lady butterflies every year in Iowa that didn't hibernate here. They had to come on storm fronts. So insects get redistributed on storm fronts, on these storms. But I'm sure there's a pretty high fatality rate when the world is collapsing around you at 185 miles an hour and rain up to 30 inches at a time. The insects are suffering too.
All right, Chris, thanks a lot for your call. Let's do a few more email questions here. Kate says, we want to plant a contender peach tree for our daughter's second birthday this weekend. Do you have any suggestions so it has the best chance to do well? We live in Des Moines.
Okay. Make sure it's a well-drained soil. They insist on a well-drained soil and plenty of sun. Those two things.
All right. And how well do you think it will do?
Contender is one of the better varieties. Basically, it's Contender and Reliance. Those are the two most cold hardy. And hope for a winter that is not a repeat of this past winter, because that was very cold.
All right. Here's a question from John in Johnston. We have a few fruit trees in the backyard that appear to be dwarf plum. Do you have some suggestions on how I can find out what kind of trees they are and if the fruit is safe to eat?
Well, if they haven't been sprayed by anyone, they should be safe to eat. As far as a variety, boy, that's tough. I'm not sure that's possible.
All right. There are lots and lots of
varieties
out there. Okay. From Sarah in Iowa City, I'd like to convert a portion of my front sloped yard in Iowa City to a wildflower garden, probably about 300 square feet. Any advice on whether I should use a wildflower seed mix versus individual plants? I don't necessarily want it to look landscaped. I like the wild look. Also, I know there are advantages and disadvantages to fall and spring plantings. So when would be the best time to plant?
I think I would go on the computer and go to a website like Prairie Moon Nursery. They sell basically native plants. They sell plants and seed. And some of these are basically small little seedlings. And so they could go online and check to see what they have, check the price of the mix as far as the seed mix, but also check the price on some of these seedlings to see which one is best for them. As far as seeding, you would have to destroy the existing vegetation by some means. As far as sowing seed, it's typically kind of late spring or fall as far as sowing seed. But if you buy plants, obviously spring would be a great time.
All right. Robert has a question for you. My zinnia leaves are covered in white. Should these plants be added to compost later in the season?
Sure. Powdery mildew, very common on zinnia. You see it on lilacs, on Monarda, very, very common on peonies, but you can compost it.
All right. Kaylin says, I think September's a good time to dig up peonies. Can you give me tips to make the transplant as healthy for the plants?
It's pretty easy. I would probably wait till the end of the month or so and then just cut them off at the ground and dig them up. And if you want to, you can divide it. Just make sure the clump has at least 3 to 5 eyes per clump and replant and position those sections back in the ground at the same depth they were growing previously. Water nicely, water a few times this fall, and they should be fine.
All right. Here's a question from Barbara in Mason City. I have two large milkweed plants in my yard that were planted to help monarch butterflies. The stalks and pods are covered with yellow aphids, and I haven't found any monarch caterpillars on the plants. What do I do to get rid of these aphids without damaging the plants, and how can I prevent them from taking them over next year?
The yellow aphids on milkweed are called oleander aphid, and it just happens. And they are on the stalks. They didn't interfere with any monarchs. It was just a random chance that the monarch female would find your plant anyway, and apparently she didn't. The aphids were not an issue. The aphids and the monarchs can coexist on the same plant. If the oleander aphids and their beautiful bright yellow color with the black cornicles doesn't appeal to you. They are hawkeye colored, by the way. if that doesn't appeal to you, they can be killed with soapy water, and the soapy water spray that you put along the stem will kill the aphids on contact and not interfere with the caterpillar that might be somewhere else on the plant. So bright yellow aphids on milkweed just happen, and they're part of the joy of seeing the variety of nature.
But also lady beetles will eat them.
Yeah, that's right. It's a good food source.
All right. So ignore them is what I'm hearing you say.
You know, if you can, if you can't, I would plant Heliopsis next to it. Heliopsis is another ornamental that you can plant in your garden. Heliopsis gets a bright red aphid. And so you now have cardinal and gold aphids together in your garden.
Perfect. Mark is on the line in Fairfield. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
Good. I've got a large firebush for many years in our backyard. This year is the first time that I've seen some of the branches beginning to defoliate and almost look like they're dying. I went out just to check it over a couple of days ago, and I swear that these holes were dug in the ground, almost looking like mole holes. We've never had moles in our backyard. It's the first time I've seen it. But is it possible that there are moles growing or digging down there and eating the roots? And then how do I handle this, or what do I do with the plant that actually a good percentage of it looks like it may not come back next year?
Well, first of all, you typically don't see a hole as far as a mole. What they do is they raise ridges, and so that's what you see. And so they kind of have these runs that kind of wander through the yard where they have these raised ridges. That's a mole. And they're basically feeding on earthworms and also certain insects like grubs in the soil. They do not eat plant roots. Now, if the plant roots are in the way, they'll chew through them, possibly to get from one place to another, but they're typically not going to cause sufficient damage to a well-established shrub, so I don't think that's the reason for the dieback. What I would be inclined to do probably is wait and maybe prune it back next spring. Let it leaf out first, and then prune out any dead wood.
All right, Mark, thanks a lot for your call. I think we've got time for one more. Robin on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Robin.
Hi. I have a question about a Luna moth that was chilling on my screen porch.
Mm-hmm.
And I had noticed that its hind tails were looking rather sad.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering if it was at the end of its cycle or... does it go on to lay eggs once it actually fell off the screen and landed on the ground?
Yeah.
And I thought it had died. And
no, if you're out there in the daytime, it's their sleeping period because moths are active at night. So you caught it during its inactivity period, and yeah, they get dislodged and they'll lay on the ground. Luna moths usually live for about a month, and they by now have had their time as the adult stage. She has laid her eggs. When you see those tattered, beat-up wings, it just means it's old age. The moths die in the late summer, but they have laid their eggs. The caterpillars have grown and developed and gone into the pupa stage, and that's how they're going to spend the winter so that we get more next year. But this has been a good year to find Luna moths. I've had more reports of Luna moths from people seeing them on the side of the house or seeing them on the screen than usual. So you are a lucky one again this year, and we hope to see more Luna moths in the future.
All right, Robin, thank you so much for your call, and we are out of time today. Donald Lewis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity. It's always a pleasure.
You can continue to enjoy your parties with your social wasps throughout the fall season. Iowa State University Professor of Entomology Donald Lewis. Richard Giron, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Caitlin Harrop, Rick Brewer, and Dennis Reese. And today we say goodbye again to Shirley Wong. We've had a number of opportunities to say hello and goodbye, and today is her last day this time around. We're going to miss her so much. And Shirley, thank you so much for all of your good work. And we are so excited to see what you do in the future. Your future is so very bright. Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.